The Serpentine Podcast. Time pass on work.
This is episode 3 of the Serpentine Podcast on Work. I'm your host, Victoria Sin, back again with Lucia Pietroiusti. That was part of a project by design duo Le Grand Jaeger, making national anthems from natural and environmental sounds.
So for a minute, hi Victoria.
Hi Lucia.
I honestly had a 2 second, did I just walk into the wrong podcast recording session?
Yeah, it is quite weird to like start the podcast with a national anthem. I feel like I'm like back at school or something. Something quite sinister about it, isn't it? So Lucia, do you know about Superman's Fortress of Solitude?
Again. What?
So the Fortress of Solitude was Superman's place of solace. It was a remote, concealed secret citadel in the Arctic that he could move around to different places in the world.
Uh-huh.
He also conducted secret experiments there, and it's where he would wind down from a tough day of crime fighting.
Of course.
And he kept, dangerous technology there, and of course his home gym. He also had a spare one. A spare fortress of solitude at the bottom of the Sargasso Sea.
So basically, we're just saying that Superman had a very sweet life.
Yeah, pretty sweet.
And maybe, like, architects of modern homes today are trying to recreate this feeling of this fortress of solitude when they talk about homes.
So there's actually a film by the Swiss designer and researcher Simone Niquil, which she called Fortress of Solitude, that articulates exactly that thought.
The smart home is Silicon Valley's vision of a democratic luxury provided by connected devices and floating infrastructure. Their version of Corbusier's machine for living is one of technology as ubiquitous domestic worker. Chips and silicone added to appliances and environments, performing silently as ghosts in the shell. Taking over everyday chores, repetitive tasks, and predicting our week's groceries, steadily generating our leisure time, and ensuring a seamless day-to-day. Blissful evenings of family time, connectedness, and Netflix. Individual meals, dissolving Snapchats, and time zone ignoring telepresence, all while the laundry is being folded. Magical, really, this kingdom of ours. Some might call it eerie, functioning like a perfectly oiled machine. The home used to be filled with temperament, opinions, and generations. We miss it now, that mess?
I don't know about you, but my Fortress of Solitude doesn't sound at all like that.
No, it doesn't have a child's voice with eerie background noises.
That folds my laundry.
Yeah, I mean, this thing about, like, automation in the home, we're talking about it a lot, but it's not, you know, aside from, like, Apple HomePods, which my partner actually has one of, and it is, like, very creepy, but this is, like, a very, you know, dystopian idea of, like, what, like, a home will be like. Like, we're not quite there, but maybe it's not that far away.
I mean, I find, maybe I'm just the wrong generation, but I even find clapping for your lights to go on and off to be like incredibly terrifying.
My brother had one of those when he broke his leg. It was so funny. I used to clap from the other room just to piss him off.
So before I think I've lost my mind and I'm in a parallel universe, can you tell me what the National Anthem and the Fortress of Solitude have with today's podcast?
Well, both are related to the idea of the domestic space, and that's what we're discussing today on our work podcast. We've partnered up with the Design Museum London to discuss how technology and modern working patterns are affecting our ideas about what a home should be. We'll hear more from Simone Nikhil and Le Grand Jaeger later, but first, Chief Curator of the Design Museum, Justin McGuirk, invited guests into the studio to discuss the merging of home and work.
I'm Justin McGuirk. I'm the Chief Curator at the Design Museum in London. At the Design Museum, we're working on an exhibition called Home Futures, which looks at radical visions of the home through the 20th century and how they predicted, or not, the ways in which we live today. And so what we're interested in discussing today is how the worlds of work and home are merging and what the implications of that might be. With us in the studio today are Frances Hollis and Anab Jain. I'll let them introduce themselves. Anab?
I'm Anab Jain. I'm a designer and a filmmaker, and I'm also the co-founder of a London-based design studio called Superflux. At Superflux, we imagine and build plural future worlds. We invite people to walk into these futures and experience what it might feel like to live in these worlds. The idea of this work is not to predict the future or to tell people what to do, but to instead open up possibilities for the way in which their lives might change in the future, to also show the consequences, intended and unintended, of the choices, actions, and the decisions they make today. I'm also a professor of design at the Design Investigation Studio at the University of Applied Arts in Vienna. And recently, I curated a show called How Will We Work, which looks at the challenges of how work and automation will take place in the future.
I'm Frances Hollis. I'm an architect and an academic at the Cass School of Architecture at London Metropolitan University. And I've been researching the architecture of home-based work for more than 15 years now. My interest in the subject began when I decided to set a building that combined dwelling and workplace for some students as a major design project. I went to the RIBA library to research my introductory talk, expecting to find half a dozen books on the subject, and I found nothing. Realising I might have stumbled across a gap in architectural knowledge, I taught the year out and then embarked on what has been a big journey, looking at these buildings and how home and work have been combined historically and how they're combined today. And it's led that I completed a doctorate in 2007 and published a book, Beyond Live Work, The Architecture of Home-Based Work, in 2015. It's a very big subject, and it's basically all that I do now. This is my field.
Frances, can you talk us through it? How did we traditionally understand home and work, and what was the difference?
Before the Industrial Revolution, almost everybody worked from home in one whatever occupation they did. There were different buildings depending on their occupations and their social status. With the Industrial Revolution and the invention of the factory, work moved into the invention of the collective workplace, if you like. People moved to going out to work. And this created real issues in the family where the economic production had been shared previously between men and women, and then suddenly somebody needed to stay at home to look after the children. But home-based work didn't stop with the Industrial Revolution. There's plenty of evidence that showed that it continued right the way through. And it was only, in fact, at the beginning of the 20th century when there was wide-scale opposition to home-based work. The employers didn't like it because they lost control of their employees. The unions didn't like it because they were worried about an unregulated workforce, but they also were worried that home-based work undermined their campaign for a male family wage. And general public opinion thought that a woman's place was in the home and that that was domestic and not economic role. And so it was at the beginning of the 20th century, actually, that rules and regulations were put in place to keep the two fields, the two worlds of home and work completely separate.
Anab, one of the key drivers of home working today is the internet, what some people call immaterial labour, which simply means working on laptops in the internet, whether you're a web designer or a programmer or whatever it might be. For a lot of these people who are often self-employed, they work from home. Or increasingly we hear about this breed of people who are called digital nomads who choose not to have stable home lives but can work almost anywhere. And they might rent a place with Roam or WeWork, these companies that offer them bases in London, San Francisco or Bali. And there is this sense that one can work anywhere, anytime. How normal do you think that is as a state of affairs today?
I think really normal. And I think this whole idea of digital labour or immaterial labour has sucked into everybody's life. I think every worker's lives, it has become impossible for us to switch off from our phones and laptops and not answer emails wherever you are. So in some ways, we are working more and longer hours because these boundaries have blurred than we used to before.
Frances, in your research into people working at home, are you finding that people are working in a very kind of structured and disciplined way? Or are you also noticing what Anab described, which is this sense that work has just stretched to occupy all the time that we have, that we're answering emails on the toilet and, you know, picking up our phone first thing in the morning? And what are you finding?
Some people find it extremely difficult when they start working from home. They find it very difficult controlling their family and their friends, themselves, their hours. But many people have extreme discipline. And very often, space is important in being able to set that discipline. If you're working at the kitchen table and you've got two children coming home at 3:45, your work gets interrupted in a way that can be very difficult for people to deal with. And so the whole relationship between how our homes are designed and how we manage our home-based work, I think, is crucial. My research suggests that the homes that we're building today haven't been designed with home-based work in mind at all, and that results very often in environments that make it very, very difficult to work from home, and therefore people go out to the cafes or to co-working spaces. And obviously they have to pay money for that. And one of the real benefits of working from home, for particularly for the self-employed, is they don't have to pay for it. And it's a way of using space that would otherwise be empty. If you go back historically and look at buildings that were designed for people to work from home, they were conceived as collective structures. And one of the real problems with home-based work today is social isolation. People close the front door and they're stuck. In my street, where I've lived for 30 years, I realised the statistics show there's probably between 10 and 15 home-based businesses. And until I started, I started lunches. I invited anyone in my street who worked from home to come to lunch. I had no idea who was doing what, because everyone closes their doors and they're invisible.
It's interesting because there has been this possibly small resurgence of collective living in places like San Francisco and London, where developments like The Collective offer single room, you know, small single room apartments with a lot of communal facilities and shared spaces where people can work. But there's also a sense that somehow those developments are still slightly exploitative, that really they're just for people of a certain class doing, you know, computer-based work.
Yeah.
Certainly they don't allow any craft-based work or making. So you, what you're describing sounds to me like bringing back something like a kind of guild structure where people can kind of work together and make things in the same building.
I think there are many, many, many different ways of approaching this. I mean, if you start with the existing building stock, if it was basically permitted for people to work openly from home, the average bay window could become a shop window. It could become an office window. There could be a sign on the front of the building that says Francis Hollis Architect.
Anna, you're a designer. You run a small design practice. You're also a mother. Does what Francis is describing appeal? And can you imagine that with your, you know, with your colleagues and with your peers, does contemporary technology, even manufacturing technology, make what Francis is describing more realistic or appealing to you?
We dream about that kind of a workspace, which is because we have a small practice, we have few people, and we actually tried it. But it didn't work because we have a small apartment. I was a new mother. John and I worked together and we had this baby. We'd put it to nap in the other room and we had a lovely intern, very compassionate girl. And suddenly the baby started howling and I was fine dealing with the baby, but she got so worked up that she rushed into the bedroom. What's happening to the baby? Can I help? And I was just like, whoa. This is suddenly felt like a breach of privacy. And we just didn't know how to deal with that situation. But I think there are two things. There's a regulatory aspect. So we don't have the regulatory framework to be able to work from home easily. The taxation system is very different. And socially, I think the minute I say I work from Somerset House, people are like, oh, cool, even though we're paying a lot of rent. If I say I work from home, it's the same work. In fact, we were more productive in some ways because there were fewer distractions and less commuting time. People are like, oh, okay.
So there's a social perception, a status attached to having
Definitely.
A workplace, having an office.
Yeah, we felt that very strongly.
Well, let's take this conversation in the opposite direction for a moment, because we've also noticed that workplaces are increasingly trying to emulate some of the qualities of home. If you think about tech companies like Google or Facebook, for example, they are at pains to offer their workers all of the kind of comforts and amenities of home to make them, I suppose, feel more comfortable at work. There are rest places, play areas, dry cleaning facilities, possibly even sleeping facilities. So there is this sense that why go home when you can have all of the benefits of home at work?
Yeah, that's it. Why go home? The unwritten thing is don't go home. Just stay here and work as long as you can. Come on weekends. I have friends who work at Google in these offices, and quite often they have things like work-life balance seminars, but at 9 p.m. And he has two little kids, and he's like, how on earth, what is work-life balance about this? But the idea of creating these very cozy workspaces is to make, again, to stretch work into a 24-hour period thing, that just don't go home, stay here and keep working for us.
I think that the domestication of the workplace started as a way to try to lure women into employment. It's worked beautifully. I agree with Anna saying that absolutely it is designed. You know, you can have a beer there, you can play pool with your friends, it's about making a whole environment. So why would you go home? I think that it's very problematic. I think that it's really difficult working in those environments. I mean, when I worked in an office with a number of other people, if I wanted to do any serious thinking or writing, I went home. You know, I just think you can't work effectively when you're listening to everyone else's phone calls and you've got all the distractions of people coming and going the whole time.
Anna, Francis described earlier how the home was a construct in the 20th century that really kept women at home, working, doing domestic labour, unpaid. And really from the mid-20th century onwards, there was this project to automate the home, to provide washing machines and better hoovers and things that would make the housewife's work easier, create more leisure time. Now there's a new breed of such devices, which we call smart devices for the smart home. We have robotic vacuum cleaners. We've got speakers that can answer all our questions for us, smart thermostats and everything. I think it's debatable whether that is actually minimizing the amount of domestic labor that gets done, or at least the time that domestic labor takes. But what's your perception of how the smart home helps or doesn't help in domestic labor?
So I think there's a certain kind of design of these smart devices. If you talk about the speakers or any kind of intelligent device in the home, follow this pattern of command and control. So you ask it a question and it must answer back. So in some ways you are shifting what you would do yourself, as in pick up your phone or use the internet to find something out, to this device. So it's that form of labor that's getting transferred. It is quite interesting cognitively what that might do to us over a long period of time if we get really used to not having to think or challenge ourselves about some of these things, because there's at a flick of a switch or at an instant question, there is an answer that pops back. And it's quite fascinating. I think some of these devices are very useful, but there's a flip side to it, as in they are listening to you. And we have sort of very passively just accepted these devices into our home and are okay to have them listening to our conversations, because they're collecting the data that's going to help us in better answering the questions we have for them. So this becomes more than just labor or work. This is a question of what we allow into our very private spaces. And then there's a question of privacy, and have you already given up that idea a long time ago? Homes in many parts of the world are very open. There are verandas and there are windows that look into each other's houses. People don't seem to mind it. So is that a Western construct, this idea of privacy? I think it just opens up a whole load of other questions.
So it's interesting because we're filling our homes with devices that need to collect our data in order to do their jobs properly. Mm-hmm. And so in a sense, one could say that the home is becoming a new factory. The home is a workplace because we're generating data all the time, which is feeding the business models of these big tech companies. The home is a data factory, really, isn't it? It's a place where we produce information all the time, whether it's collected covertly by smart speakers or whether we're posting on Instagram or Facebook and creating more data. Somehow the home has become a real kind of node of data collection that is producing wealth that we never see.
By and large, we are giving all sorts of private data, which is being stored on what is actually someone else's computer.
Perhaps we could think about this at an urban scale. Francis, you were talking about more people being able to make things at home, small crafts and light industry coming back. Obviously, traditionally, these were separated from city centres. They were pushed to the edges or even out of cities altogether. Can you imagine this coming back into the centre of cities so that suddenly the city centre is or even any kind of domestic or residential area can be a thriving hub of manufacturing?
Absolutely. And in fact, it hasn't vanished as much as we think it has. If you look closely, obviously it's against all the rules and regulations. People are doing all sorts of mending and making in the city and very often living in their workshops or in their studios when they're doing this mending and making. I think one of the things I feel has gone horribly wrong is the idea that where we live has to be silent, that residential areas should be super quiet. And I think it's just a complete mistake. If you take cities like Sheffield, every terrace street would have gaps in it through which you could drive a vehicle through, and in the back there would be workshops making cutlery, making nails, making all sorts of stuff. And the making and the living were completely interwoven. And the people that I've interviewed who live on industrial estates say they love it. You know, if you've got small children, an industrial estate is a really good place to be because it means that during the day, you've got lots of people around you, everyone's working. In the evening and the weekend, it's nice and quiet. So it's a sort of, it's a really interesting conundrum that there's this stereotype of residential as quiet, which I think, I mean, I just think it's, I think it's a mistake. I'm not quite sure how we shift it.
One does have to be mindful, though, of other people and the noise of your making and when you're working, which is not so much the case with digital labour. If you're typing away at a laptop, your neighbour's not going to complain. But if you're maybe working with a saw or even a 3D printer, I mean, I'm wondering whether, just to be devil's advocate here, whether the merging of work and life that we've discussed previously in kind of digital labour means that people are used to working when they want, flexi time and all of that. If you're doing small manufacturing, you'd have to be quite respectful of the people living next door.
Yes, but I think this very much is to do with community. And I think there is this phenomenon. I mean, I live in a terraced house and I know that if you like the people who are making the noise, you can tolerate the noise.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just back from India and people are working a lot more and it's noisier and there's an acceptance of noise. So I do agree that the laws could be more relaxed about it. But our entire economy, the world's economy, is built on property, is built on housing and on land. And actually, it's really fascinating because, you know, it was like people who own land were the old colonialists. And it's almost like people who own the data. Today, our data are the new colonialists, you might say. So in both cases, we in a way don't have choice. People don't have a choice where they live because they only can live where they can afford to. And that is quite increasingly not their choice. The digital labour, even though it's our choice, we have been so sucked into it that it's no longer our choice. We don't even own the data that we create. We don't own the land we live on. It's quite an interesting phenomenon.
I think it might be useful to make a distinction here between the work that we've identified, which is us as data-producing machines, if you like, for the tech companies, which actually we do not just in our homes, but we do as we walk around, we do everywhere we are. And our productive work in terms of earning our livings. And I think that the issue of working from home in terms of efficiency and how the two things merge together is a really, really interesting one. British Telecom, BT, were one of the innovators in the UK in terms of encouraging home-based employment. And they set up a whole work stream that says, if you want to, you can work from home. And they've got something like 13,000 home-based employees. And what they've found is that these people are more efficient. Because, of course, if you've got a piece of work, if you have to be in an office for 8 hours, the piece of work can take as long as you want it to be, because actually you've got to be there anyway. Whereas if you know that you've got a certain amount of work to do as your daily task, and if you do it really efficiently and quickly, you can go for a walk with your dog or you can play with your child, then you choose to do that. And so what they've found is that their home-based employees are a third more efficient than their office-based employees. There's another really interesting thing about the environment. They save £5,000 a year in overheads on each home-based employee because they can shrink their offices. So in effect, what you're doing by working from home is you're making the use of the overall building stock far more efficient. You're intensifying it. And so potentially, you know, all this talk about our housing problem, most space we have today is, if it's workspace, it's empty in the evenings and the weekends. And if it's home space, it's empty during the day, which means that we're using our space really at about 50% efficiency. If we started to inhabit our spaces round the clock, then we absolutely have enough space to house everyone in the country. You know, it really isn't a problem. So I think the issue of efficiency, I think there's a lot of scaremongering about if you work from home, you can't set boundaries around your work. I don't think that's just a problem for home-based workers. I think that's a problem for every single person who's in employment at the moment. Actually, setting your own discipline that says you do not look at work emails or you do not answer work calls after 6 o'clock in the evening and before 9 o'clock in the morning is a sort of, in a way, it's an intellectual task that we all have to, we have to make a decision about. We have to decide where we want to set our own boundaries. And I don't think in a way it's particularly bad for the home-based worker, because in some ways the home-based work very much depends on space. Again, you know, if you've got, most people I've interviewed prefer some degree of spatial separation, apart from the artists, between the work function and the home function. So, you know, for you, the whole issue of how you might take your design studio and have it as a home-based working environment. I'm thinking of Sarah Wigglesworth Architects, who has maybe 10 employees, and she's designed a building for herself that is an L-shaped building, and one wing is her home and the other wing is her office, and there's a sort of pivot space in the middle that during the day becomes a meeting room, and at night it becomes a dining room, and there's a really clear boundary between the two spaces. And I think that one of the problems we've got is that the story you told about your employee going in, setting those boundaries is really difficult in an apartment. The apartments that are built today are still built to a design that was set out at the beginning of the 20th century specifically. It was developed specifically to prevent home-based work because everyone was so opposed to it. The standard apartment design makes home-based work really, really difficult. So it's a really big design issue. It's just like how we can start to redesign our environment in the face of these sort of huge global changes.
I mean, by and large, that's true. But I have found a lot of employees in these big in large organizations are allowed to work from home, but also given another phone. And I don't think you are quite often in the position to be able to dictate the boundaries. If you've been given an email account or a Blueberry or whatever it used to be, and now whatever smartphone, you are expected to reply and answer. In some countries, most like in India, if a client calls me on a Sunday, in my practice, I'd have to answer them. And go and meet them if necessary. So I think it's also expectations that with technology, the expectations have increased that now I have you on my beck and call for 24 hours. That if this is an urgent thing, you must answer back even if it's 2 a.m. So I think there is, it's harder to, it is whether you work from home or not, those boundaries have become harder to maintain.
I guess we're talking about the difference between Francis, people who are doing their own work, often creative work, and people who are working for companies, which could be creative or might be any other kind of work. And in one, you want a distinction between your private life and your work life, and in the other, they can merge or flow and be continuous.
Yes, I think you're right. And I think that in a way, we're at the beginning of this whole new way of living and working. And so people are having to work out how to regulate. You know, organisations, I think you're right. I think there is a lot of exploitation in organisations now that people are available 24 hours a day. I think that's for all employees. And I think that's something that we need, that society needs to really get a grip on, that actually it's not acceptable for us to be available to our employees or our clients 24 hours a day.
We're coming to the end of our conversation, so I'd like to thank Anab and Francis for joining me here today. In closing, perhaps you could make a small prediction about the way you see work life and home life going in the coming years. Anab, how about you?
My focus has been around technology and automation, so I think not so much a prediction, but a fear that we are not recognizing what human dignity is when it comes to certain kind of jobs that are getting automated, and the quite disastrous consequences of millions of people who will lose their jobs in years to come. And my hope is that we are able to understand those consequences and start designing schemes, regulations, habitation, and opportunities for people to be able to really maintain their dignity and do the work that is not only satisfying, but perhaps necessary for the future of the planet.
And Francis?
I think the world is changing very rapidly. And I think that the way we build to accommodate it isn't. And so I think there's a real collision in process. We're at the beginning of that. And I have a lot of fear about that, because I think that the environments that we're building at the moment are so mismatched to the way that people are going to be living their lives in the future. I share the fear that millions will lose their jobs, but I have an optimism that people will start in all sorts of creative enterprises. They will work out how to make and do and earn their livings without these big employers. But I think there's a real problem if we don't start to design for it. And I think that what's needed are much less prescriptive, functionally determined buildings, and much more open, flexible, adaptable spaces that people can go into in order to start to develop a life that matches the way that society in the whole is going.
What I found really interesting about that right off the bat was, like, I didn't know that the separation of home and work only started as we know it with the Industrial Revolution.
That kind of struck me as well, also in its clarity, because I feel like it undoes all of this kind of really reactionary conversations around natural roles and sort of separations of genders and things like this that would have those roles to be very anciently set. And instead, what we're talking about is, you know, 100-something years, and before that it was a whole different sort of the landscape of work and home, the landscape of gender, all of it was completely different.
Definitely.
And in a way, the sort of revolution that in theory things like washing machines and those forms of material domestic laborers or technological domestic laborers, one of their kind of greatest claim is always that they made female or domestic work less onerous, whereas they sort of isolate. And I mean, I find that to be really striking also in the way that communities of childcare no longer sort of seem to be existing, at least, you know. When Justin talked about emailing from the toilet, I remembered that I found out I was pregnant in the toilets of the Serpentine.
Oh my God.
20 minutes before a performance.
Did you do a pregnancy test at work?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And so a part of me was like,
why did you do that?
I don't know. So a part of me was like, why did I do that?
Yeah.
And another part of me was like, of course.
Yeah.
I've been here. It's sort of, you know, those 12 hours a day that you need in order to get those things done. And this is the place that I feel the most, I guess, I have the most amount of agency in.
It was Einab who said, like, they had an intern who was helping them, like, work from their place and kind of, like, infringed a little bit when they came into, like, the child's bedroom who was crying, being like, can I do anything? Like, do you have anything like that where you're really, you know, this is for home and this is for work?
I was surprised by the feeling that Einab had.
Yeah.
In the sense that even though clearly she wasn't, like, angry about it or anything, but she felt like a kind of invasion of privacy that I've never felt.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, when I was away from work, I tried to freelance as much as possible and tried to work, because that was the only identity that I kind of knew about. And so the idea that the merging of the work life and home life, to me, I interpret as the world and society and the people I love have accepted that child and the new identity that child. So I love sort of colleagues babysitting. Not that they do, but
no, but that's what you would want, is like maybe this separation is still too, like, militarized or, like, socially unacceptable to, like, be a mother and, like, admit, like, yes, I'm a mother and I take care of my child and, like, sometimes it needs to come to work with me.
I mean, another thing about privacy, if Einab felt quite sort of infringed upon by this entering is how much of the outside is already entering, like all this data gathering, this kind of factory that Justin talked about a little bit.
And definitely. I mean, she said, like, how much have we given up on the idea of privacy?
Right. And there's something of that in Simone's Fortress of Solitude, isn't there? This idea that there's, like, lots of voices.
Mm. In the full video that the clip is from, there's kind of, like, a back and forth with the protagonist talking to the home, and the home is kind of, like, infringing on her role as a mother, but also, like, a human. And this thing of, like, you know, sinister technologies is really pervasive.
And actually, Simone's work was in Work, Body, Leisure, which was the Dutch pavilion at the Venice Architecture Biennale this year. Who were our partners on the last podcast?
Hi, my name is Simone Key, and I'm a designer and researcher based in Amsterdam. My practice, Technoflesh, investigates the representation of identity without a body, the digitization of corporate reality through new capture technologies, and explores its consequences. What we will hear are sound clips from my essay film, Fortress of Solitude, from 2014. The film was created while I was part of the architecture collective Space Caviar. Together, we were commissioned to produce an artistic contribution and reflection on the contemporary home by the Biennale Intérieur, which takes place in Kortrijk, a city in Belgium. What struck us is that the objects and show operate under the preconception that the audience indeed does have a home. Current statistics and developments in property prices, work precarity, and family configurations propose otherwise. Fortress of Solitude is an essay film in three chapters exploring the dichotomy of inviting automation technology into one's home for the sake of hygiene, safety, or assistance, with the result of installing potential listening devices into one's private spaces. Is the home becoming a data machine rather than architecture for living? Are the most private spaces broadcasting lives involuntarily instead of providing shelter?
These are our homes. No trespassing. Private property. We indulge in a contradiction of owner's pride and paranoia. Instagram posts of last night's dinner, but locked front doors. We spin a web of listening devices around our most intimate spaces, attempting to protect what is dear and hold close remotely. Networked optics installed in high-up corners, domestic fisheye vision streaming to our smartphones. The possibility to enter any room at any time without being there. Spatial oversight, calming security. Yes, baby Rose is still soundly asleep. We add senses to architecture, transforming our homes into agents rather than dwellings. Agents who communicate with us, for us, and about us. Agents who assist, ever-present and ubiquitous. Smart agents, our homes. Welcome home.
For Fortress of Solitude, I strictly wanted to record only indoors. The challenge of getting access to indoor spaces was part of the script, as well as an investigation of accessibility. The spaces featured are a mix of Airbnbs, a hostel room at Hong Kong's Chungking Mansions, a city in a building situated next to the Mira, the hotel Edward Snowden stayed in during his hideout in Hong Kong, a military bunker turned luxury hotel in Switzerland. Throughout the film, a fictional maternal figure communicates with their smart home about the well-being of the child at home while out at work, possibly running errands as someone else's automation as a task rabbit. The film has a soundtrack commissioned by musician Mesh with the prompt to imagine wind blowing through an open window of a smart home.
Thank you.
So that was another clip from designer and researcher Simone Nikhil.
So, Victoria, you already have a HomePod in your house.
Well, my partner has a HomePod in her room.
Okay. It's in your house.
It's super creepy. And actually, I think there's like an Alexa or like one of the other ones also somewhere else in another room.
Would you make it smarter than that?
No, I don't know.
No. That's a hard no.
Whenever you say, hey, Siri, it goes, mm-hmm.
Oh, God. Does it?
Yeah.
I have to admit that I've never actually even seen one of these things.
Yeah. So this is the first time I'd actually, you know, like been in a room with one of them. And you say like, hey, Siri. And then it says, mm-hmm. And then you like ask it a question. So it's always on. Like it's always listening. And I know that there's probably not somebody like in a room somewhere at like, you know, Apple headquarters being like, I will listen and like really care like what's going on in this like random bedroom, you know, somewhere far away. But it's just the idea that like somebody is always listening.
When you were saying that, I was thinking, well, it doesn't really matter to me whether it's a machine or a person.
Mm-hmm.
Because the third person thing has then been internalized. Like I'm then thinking of myself in a third-person way, and I don't feel like entirely... I don't know what natural means. Natural doesn't mean anything, but I don't feel entirely sort of... I'm not... There's a few layers of sort of self-checking, a little bit like when you're recording a podcast, for example, where you're sort of hearing yourself.
Yeah, of course.
You're watching yourself do things. Once you've created a world in which the potential of being listened to is there all the time, and you sort of grow up with the notion that you're being listened to all the time. Like, how much does that come in the way of, like, thinking like you can act or you can sort of, there are things you can change or thinking about yourself even as an individual? Like, how will the brain react to just having this internalized listening device all the time? I don't know.
Yeah, of course. Or, like, the feeling of, like, never quite being alone.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, like, I don't really want that technology to become, like, smarter or, like, more, like, anthropomorphized. If anything, like, I'm, you know, like the protagonist in Simone Nikhil's essay, I am quite happy with it staying the machine and me staying the human.
Do you think it will kill some form of intimacy, like, the most secret forms of intimacy? Like, would someone with a particular fetish in game, like, have a intense relationship with someone in relation to that fetish with Siri in the room?
Maybe. I don't know. It depends on the person. Like, also, I think maybe we're just not used to it yet. Like, maybe I'm just not used to having Siri in the room. And actually, in a few years, like, I'll just be totally fine with Siri hearing, like, you know, my deepest and darkest, you know, what goes on wherever. So this is a great segue into our last clip. Legrand Jaeger are a multimedia design duo made up of Guimet Legrand and Ava Jaeger. They investigate how the designed world, especially new technology, is shaping ethics. They are currently designers in residence at the Design Museum. In Sniffer series, Legrand Jaeger used the concept of the smart home device to set themselves a challenge. They tried to conceptualize the soundscape that these machines internalize while sniffing homes for data from which they learn. Legrand Jaeger took natural noises recorded by smart home devices, teeth brushing, couples' arguments, the TV, a vacuum cleaner, and so on. They then fed them all into an algorithm that formatted the sounds into a linked sequence, creating a kind of mosaic based on the format of the British national anthem. So, you know, potentially, my deepest and darkest would maybe be disguised in here somewhere. But for now, we're going to let Legrand Jaeger play us out. Lucia, I was wondering if you had anything you wanted to mention first, like if there was some kind of like event coming up with a Serpentine.
I don't know. Maybe the work marathon's coming up. On the 22nd of September, we're gathering lots of artists and thinkers and scientists and technologists together to think about work together. So hopefully these three conversations will lead us quite nicely into some of the thoughts that are going to be debated there.
Yes.
And then we'll continue.
Definitely. And I will also be backstage running around interviewing the contributors and attendees. So you'll hear some of that in the following podcasts. For anybody who doesn't know or won't be able to make it, where will it be, and how can people listen?
So it's happening at the Royal Geographical Society in London.
Mm.
There's going to be a whole host of performances and activities that go on also in the Serpentine Pavilion and around the Serpentine Gallery.
Great.
And we are live streaming the whole thing on radio.serpentinegalleries.org. So tune in and join us. Come.
Yes, join us.
The Serpentine Podcast. On work.
Thank you for listening to episode 3 of the Serpentine Podcast on Work. I've been your host, Victoria Sin. You can listen to the whole series at radio.serpentinegalleries.org or subscribe with your podcast provider. The Serpentine Podcast on Work is curated by Lucia Pietriusti and Kay Watson. Guest curators for this episode were Sumitra Upham and Justin McGuirk from the Design Museum. We were produced by Jesse Lawson and Jack Howson from Reduced Listening, with sound design by Dane Law. Next episode will air after the Serpentine Marathon on the 22nd of September. We hope to see you there, but don't worry if you can't make it, as we'll be highlighting some of our favorite marathon moments on this podcast. We'll leave you today with the United Kingdom National Anthem from Sniffer Series by LeGrand Jaeger, featuring domestic sounds including a man peeing, a pill bottle, boiling water, an Attenborough TV program, and a light bulb.